Well, good morning, everyone. I was thinking about how to try to start off our service today, start off our sermon today, and I was thinking, when we look at the topic today, that there's one thing that became a dread of mine all throughout pretty much every level of my schooling that's a perfect illustration to start things off. And anybody remember going through school and having to do a group project? Anybody remember that? How many of you liked going through school and doing that group project? Is there anybody? Okay. There's a couple of, did I say weirdos? Is that okay to say, you know, but lovely people who really enjoy group projects. For the rest of us, you know, we know why. Inevitably, I would be the one that would end up doing it while other people in the group were like, oh, I'll get my part in, and then like the day before, or, you know, mere hours before, you know, send me a message, hey, you know what, I didn't figure out my part, I'm really sorry, you know, hope it goes well tomorrow. Yeah, I planned for that, bro, I kind of saw that one coming, you know. Students hate them because there's always somebody that doesn't pull their weight. I was looking at group project horror stories online, just trying to see, you know, I mean, I've had my own, but they aren't nearly as bad as the guy whose lab partner, you know, they were doing this experiment with mice, and the lab partner, you know, he had to leave, and so he left the mice with the lab partner, and the lab partner let the mice die, and then didn't even tell him, but just gave him the thing back, you know, didn't even figure it out, didn't take care of them, do anything. Or, you know, the group that, you know, everybody, you know, had that one moment in class, they exchanged their email addresses and all that kind of stuff, and then nothing. And one person that's kind of, okay, sending the email out, and then literally less than 24 hours before, the panic, oh, what are we going to do? And of course, the one person ended up doing everything because didn't hear from anybody else, even from the two people who had dropped the course without even telling, you know. Just crazy, crazy stuff. So why on earth do teachers assign them? And I will give you a side note. As a teacher, I've never assigned a group project in my biblical interpretation class. I encourage students to talk, you know, and to discuss it, but do your own work. The reason teachers assign them, I guess it's good to learn how to collaborate with others. There's this idea that we need to prepare for the real world. And frankly, there's some truth to that. I can tell you that in my experience here in the church, a lot of what we do as a leadership group, pastors and elders getting together, is a group project, thinking through and problem solving as a group, and there's tremendous value in that. We learn how to work together sometimes in spite of our differences. Those are good things. The challenge with doing that in school is that it's just for a grade. It's not your livelihood on the line. You're not unified in purpose. And so when we look at the tremendous value of working together in a group, where we see it shine is when you have a group that is motivated. Every individual part of the group motivated, working together. And when that happens, the effect of a group of individuals working together, pulling the same load, can accomplish far more than the abilities of any one individual could do. Sometime, you know, over a matter of years or even a lifetime. We're going to look today at a group project in the book of Nehemiah. And if you've got your Bibles, I'd like you to open up to Nehemiah chapter 3. I debated whether or not I would read all verses for you. You'll see there's a lot of repetition. I want to do so, and I'll do so kind of quickly, but we're not going to spend time dealing with each individual thing. I want to make a couple of overall comments where we see an example of a group of people motivated, working together, accomplishing something that was amazing in a short period of time. If we recall from last week, the people of Israel were exiled, had been exiled from their land by Babylon. And when the Persians rose to power, the Persians allowed them to return to their land. Nehemiah was a Jewish man serving in the court of the Persian king Artaxerxes, and he obtained royal permission to rebuild Jerusalem, and particularly the walls of Jerusalem, which had lain in shambles for over 150 years. Last week, we saw Nehemiah call the people and say, look, here's what God's led me to do. Guys, let's rise up and get the walls. Let's build them. And the people said yes. And now we start and we get a chance to see that process. It says in Nehemiah 3:1 that Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests. They built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of Hundred and as far as the Tower of Hananel. And next to him, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zakur, the son of Imri, built. The sons of Hassanah built the fish gate. They laid its beams and set its doors and its bolts and its bars. And next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired. And next to them, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshazabel, repaired. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Bana, repaired. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired. But their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. Joada, the son of Paseh, and Meshulam, the son of Besodiah, repaired the gate of Yeshanah. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them repaired Melatiah, the Gibeonite, and Jardon, the Maronophite, the men of Gibeah, the men of Mitzpah, the seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them, Uziel, the son of Harhiah, goldsmiths, repaired. Next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired. And they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Raphiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. Next to him, Jediah, the son of Harumph, repaired opposite his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of Hashabaniah, repaired. Malchijah, the son of Harim, and Hashub, the son of Pahath Moab, repaired another section and the Tower of the Ovens. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired he and his daughters. Hanun and the inhabitants of Zenoah repaired the west gate. They rebuilt it and set its bolts, its doors, its bolts, its bars, and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate. Malchijah, the son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth Hacharem, repaired the dung gate. He repaired it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And Shalom, the son of Kolhazeh, ruler of the district of Mitzpah, repaired the fountain gate. He rebuilt it and covered it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And he built the wall of the pool of Shelah, the king's garden, and as far as the stairs that go down from the city of David. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, ruler of half the district of Bethzur, repaired a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool, and as far as the house of the mighty men. After him, the Levites repaired. Rehum, the son of Bani, next to him, Hashabiah, ruler of half the district of Keilah, repaired for his district. After him, their brothers repaired. Bavai, the son of Hendad, the ruler of half the district of Keilah. Next to him, Azer, the son of Yeshua, ruler of Mitzpah, repaired another section opposite the ascent to the armory at the buttress. After him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, repaired another section from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. After him, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the door of the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib. And after him, the priests, the men of the surrounding area, repaired. After them, Benjamin and Hashub repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Maaseiah, the son of Ananiah, repaired beside his own house. After him, Binui, the son of Hendad, repaired another section from the house of Azariah to the buttress and to the corner. Palal, the son of Uzziah, repaired opposite the buttress and the tower projecting from the upper house of the king at the court of the guard. After him, Pedaiah, the son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on Ophel repaired to a point opposite the water gate on the east and the projecting tower. After him, the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting wall as far as the wall of Ophel. Above the horse gate, the priests repaired, each one opposite his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, repaired opposite his own house. After him, Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, repaired. After him, Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanum, the sixth son of Zalpah, repaired another section. After him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, repaired opposite his chamber. After him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired as far as the house of the temple servants and of the merchants, opposite the muster gate and to the upper chamber of the corner. And between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. Whew. Thank you. Here's a representation of the city of Jerusalem. And one of the reasons I wanted to read this for you is that when you read this list, it's amazing how many people were involved in the work of building the wall. It wasn't just a small group of craftsmen that got together and did this. And probably you could have got that if you looked through and just kind of scanned through this. But there's something powerful when you see the name of every person that was recorded as having contributed. And actually, many of the commentators have noted that some people, where it talked about them, that they did another section. Because it didn't mention them doing a first section, that there may even have been some things, because of the stereotype nature of this, that in the copying, some bits may have fallen out. Some names may actually even have been lost. But a group of people motivated built the wall of Jerusalem. And we're going to see, this is kind of a summary picture of it. There's some hitches that come along the way. Next week, we're going to see that the people who were in the surrounding areas of Jerusalem actually were pretty upset at how fast the work was progressing. They didn't think the Jews were going to be able to do it. And they were so surprised and shocked that they actually threatened physical violence against Jerusalem and the people that were doing this work because they could tell that the hand of God was upon them. I put this up just so that you can see Jerusalem actually was much smaller than the area that it was probably before the exile. This little bit along here was part of Jerusalem before Babylon came in, tore down the walls, and tore the nation into exile. And one of the decisions that Nehemiah had to make was to take the wall and cut a new line to make the city defensible for the population that was there at the time. What we want to do is we want to see and talk about a couple of bits when this group of people, a diverse group, got together and what they were able to do. We learned something about the power in unity. And the first thing that I want you to see is that people of faith direct their activity toward God-given purposes. All right, people of faith direct their activity toward God-given purposes. For Nehemiah, for the Jews at this time living in Jerusalem, building the wall was a God-given purpose. Now, wall does a couple of things for you, especially if you're in the ancient world. Number one, it is physical protection. Okay? There are enemies out there. And in the ancient world, they typically don't have standing armies, and Star Wars missile defense systems, Patriot rockets and all that kind of stuff. If somebody's going to come in, you have to have a wall to defend yourself. That's the technology of the day. If you don't have that, it means that raiders can come in, sneak in the city. They can kill people, take people as slaves, do all kinds of things. And so you're incredibly vulnerable. The nation had been, that the city had been vulnerable for 150 years. It's never able to amass much wealth because, if there's, a great bank or something like that, if you're a robber, there's no reason that you can't just go in. If you, plan a great train robbery or something like that, you can go in and you can steal, anything of value that's brought into the city if there are no walls, if there's no way of defending. But the wall was something more for the nation of Israel because it had lain in ruin for 150 years. And we've talked about before that the reason that it was in ruin is because the nation was disobedient to God. When they walk by broken down walls, it is a visible and tangible reminder to them that they are out of favor with God. Building a wall is an evidence of restoration. And that means that the destruction, the defeat, the sin has been atoned for. God's favor is back with us. His hand of protection is there, and the wall is a visible symbol of that. One final thing that the wall does is it helps keep the people distinct, to help them keep their identity instead of just merging with everybody, in the surrounding area, many of which were non-Jews. Many of which did not worship the God of Israel the way that those living in Jerusalem did. Building a wall had a sense of reaffirming their sense of identity, keeping their community unity as a holy people who have a special relationship with God. That's why it was a God-given purpose at the time period. And that's why Nehemiah was raised up by God to bring about the rebuilding of the wall. Now today, it's not like God's calling us to go out and to build a wall around Phoenix. That's not what, how we would apply this today. But when we think of that as a God-given purpose for the nation of Israel, the question becomes, well, what is our God-given purpose as Christians living in this day and age? And just as Nehemiah was called to lead people towards that God-given purpose, I'd suggest to you that really we find in the New Testament a main purpose, being ourselves, faithful followers of Christ. And part of that is going out and making faithful followers of Christ so that through both of those things, being a disciple, making disciples, we build the church up in love. That's our purpose. And there's lots of passages that look at that in the New Testament. Ephesians 4, we'll look at it a little bit, and Matthew 28, go and make disciples of all the nations. That's our purpose. That's why we're here. That's why the moment that we became followers of Christ, he didn't just say, okay, you're a follower of Christ, you know, boom, I'm going to rapture you up, you know, beam you up, Scotty, you know, and then, you know, we're done. You have no more to do. You become a follower, that's it. He left us here because he has a job for us to do. That's our purpose. And so people of faith direct their activity towards God-given purposes. What we see with the nation of Israel is that recognizing that God's purpose was for them to build this wall, people rose up and they did it. The challenge for us as the church today is to recognize that God has called us to be disciples and make disciples. We too need to rise up and to take that challenge, grip it tightly, and live it for the rest of our lives. And I've got a challenge for us as North American Christians is that we forget that a lot. You hear that on Sunday morning, and that's great. You go home, and there's going to be some football on today, and, you know, by the time that's done, you know, we've forgotten that this is, I only bring up football. I'm not a huge football watcher. My wife is the one. I'm glad that, you know, you guys mentioned, because I didn't even know which two teams were playing in the Super Bowl until right now. There we go. So, but for those people who watch football, for other people like me who get their heads in a book, you know, it can be easy to lose the sense that we have a purpose, right? And so one of the things that we see that's important is that if we were left on our own, we would probably lose that. If we were left on our own, we'd forget, you know, we're busy with our own selfish things. And that's why we see a second thing with this list. People of faith cooperate with one another to achieve their God-given purposes. If I was on my own, you know, it would be up to me to remember. But if I'm working with other people, if I'm part of a group project that's depending on me to pull my weight, and I'm depending on other people, you know, when I see somebody that's flagging, I'm there to encourage them, kick their butt if need be, and encourage them, you know, some more. And they do the same for me so that we can work together. Notice, and one of the reasons I read this list is that notice that this list, unity does not mean uniformity. We are all individuals. These people were united in purpose. They were focused on what God called them to do, but man, they were people that came from all over the map when it came to, you know, their backgrounds. 38 individual workers are mentioned here. 42 different groups of people working together. And look at this. People from all professions and trades. You've got nobles. You've got priests. Even the high priest is willing to take off, you know, fancy garments and get in and get hands dirty. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when on a work day here, when you see elders and pastors, you know, crawling through, you know, attics and getting covered in paint and all that kind of stuff to do work, everybody was involved. You know, there wasn't somebody that said, oh, that work's beneath me. Well, except one group. We'll talk about them. Merchants, tradesmen, citizens, their families, even a man and his daughters were involved in the work on the wall. In fact, there were people from outlying villages. Jerusalem was such, and the walls of Jerusalem were such an important part in just Jewish, you know, the area of Judea, that people from surrounding areas came in and contributed to the work. You'd have to think that they were giving up part of their own livelihood to be able to do that, to travel in and to do that. They knew they were part of this community. Even though they didn't receive the direct benefits of, you know, the protection of the wall or anything like that, they came. There's enormous effort here from a group of different individuals working together. And here's the key. Everybody that came in recognized that their personal goals, their personal pride, their ambition needed to be set aside to work towards the larger task that God had called them to do. And that's one of the things that's important for us in the church age today. We have a unity of purpose. We know what that purpose is. But there's a diversity in the way that we make a contribution to that purpose. You know, Jesus prayed for his followers in John 17 that we, he said they, but that we may all be one just as God and Christ are one. That's where we have unity. But at the same time, Paul was able to teach in 1 Corinthians 12 that there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are varieties of service, but the same Lord. There are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who empowers them all in everyone. And that means that though we're united, you know what? We're all different. thankfully, right? You know, some of us like football, some of us, all right, we'll watch the Super Bowl for the commercials, right? You know? That's okay. God wires us each differently. And the whole thing is that we see an amazing picture in Nehemiah where people with all kinds of different backgrounds recognize the importance of a task and work toward it. The call for us as Christians today is to do the same thing. For our task, with all of us and our unique gifts, are we willing to bring them and give them to the Lord, work together to build his kingdom, to grow one another and our church in love? And that means not just one another, you know, the folks that are here, and I'm preaching to the choir, right? Many of you are in the choir, you know, but even those who aren't in the choir, you're part of the choir in that metaphorical sense. You know, you're here, you recognize that. There are people who need to be brought into the church that need to see that and experience Christ for the first time. They need to recognize the hope, the confidence, the assurance that comes from being a child of God. We're to cooperate. And that maximizes our impact. We are able to do far more as a group than we could ever do on our own. Third thing that we see is that people of faith use wisdom with regard to how they fulfill their God-given purpose. I know that we didn't get a chance, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time looking at every individual person and stuff, but one of the things, if you think about that list, maybe scan through it again, is that you'll note that Nehemiah organized the work by common interests and geography. You know, most people kind of worked on the area that was right outside their house or near to them, you know, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. You know, practically, what that allows you to do is you're more personally involved. I mean, if there's a part of the wall that you want to fail, it's not the wall, you know, that's guarding your house, you know? So there's a little bit of self-interest there, you know? I'm going to make that one good, you know? It's if I'm making it way over on the other side of the city, yeah, that one, you know, it's good enough for government work, you know, kind of thing. They wouldn't have to travel as far. So they'd save some time in doing that. And as we see next week, there was opposition. They were attacked. They wouldn't have to be tempted to leave their posts. They would want to be with their family, and their family was right in the area that they were working. They would know, okay, that they're here. I'm going to stay here. I'm not going to abandon it because I need to protect my loved ones. And the idea that the family was nearby was also probably important because I can't imagine that it wasn't a family effort. You know, you may have had, you know, mom and grandma that are making the food while everybody who's able is out there, you know, picking up the rocks. I mean, I can even see, you know, like somebody Pete or Alice's age, you know, getting buckets and carrying, you know, some of the rubble away and doing various kinds of things to all contribute as best as they could. The family was able to do so as a whole. And the fact of that wisdom and organization meant that there was amazing success. I mean, in a matter of 4 months, they rebuilt the wall. Just people giving their free time. You know, think about if you hired a contractor to do that. You know, not a guy like John Whalen. I know he'd have it done in that amount of time. But I mean, you know, if you hire most of, you know, some of the contractors that are out there, you know what I'm talking about. You've seen some of those guys. You know, they'd still be, you know, 2 years later down the road, you know, blaming and the materials didn't come in and that's why. And I got this other, you know, I'm building Nineveh. I got to do that over there, you know, or something, right? For Christians, we know our purposes, okay? What we know what we're called to do, but what wisdom helps us do is identify what opportunities for service are right up our alley. Okay, so when we think, you know, Nehemiah organized the building around this purpose, you know, with wisdom, thinking that I was going to be the best way to be able to do that. For us, we have another purpose that we're supposed to do. So wisdom for us is trying to figure out what sets me on fire. What do I get just excited about? I've often used the acronym SHAPE. S-H-A-P-E, and I put it, you've got it on the back part of your notes there, where it talks about spiritual gifts, heart, abilities and talents, personality, education and experience. This isn't the only way that we can think of the way that God has wired us, but it helps us, it's nice because it gives us a couple of different categories to think, how is it that God has wired me? Because if I find something that's in line with my spiritual gift, if I, you know, my heart leads me towards something and I find a way to use my spiritual gift in that, and then I have natural talents and abilities that God has given me that also, you know, get in with that, and it fits my personality and my experience and all that kind of stuff, I find that I'm hitting the sweet spot where, man, I get jazzed and excited to do what I do. It's one of the reasons I love to teach. I love to learn, I love to do that, and the opportunity to help, you know, people see the stuff that I've figured out, you know, and encapsulate it in a way that the light bulb goes off. I'll tell you, I just got done teaching a January term class for ACU, and it takes what I normally do in 15 weeks and compresses it to 3 weeks. So it's a few hours, you know, several hours each day, you know, Monday through Thursday, and it's pretty brutal. But I'll tell you, what's so much fun is because that's the only thing that those students are working on, man, you watch the light bulbs go off. And what kind of could happen with some students while they're reading somewhere else or doing, I get to see in the middle of class, and it's just like, boom, wow, I never realized how big and how cool God is. And you see that, and you know, that lights my fire. Some of you would much rather do anything other than stand up in front and teach. That's okay. God wires us differently. Challenge for each of us is to find what excites us. How are we wired? What are our natural talents and abilities? How do all of those things come together so that we can find that sweet spot of serving the Lord, of making a contribution that works? We have one negative bit in this list, and it's in Nehemiah 3:5. The point is, those who are unwilling to cooperate, excuse me, here's where the spirit is willing and the flesh is weak. I've been sick since Thursday, so I actually was feeling a little dizzy when I came up here. I trust that if I fall, someone else will take my notes and continue on, so just, you know, run with it. Those who are unwilling to cooperate to fulfill God-given purposes bring shame upon themselves. And the picture of everybody working, I want to read one verse again to you, and I emphasized it the first time, but here you go. Next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve the Lord. Now, isn't that interesting? I mean, not that we've ever seen leaders that, you know, would be unwilling to step in the fray and to do, you know, the real things. I mean, that's not part of our North American experience at all. But man, what a condemnation in the context of a group of people that were willing to put their own desires aside and work together. Everybody else was willing to do that in this one group of people. And we don't know why. I mean, it's possible that some people have tried to cut them a little bit of slack and suggest that, well, they were close maybe to the area where Geshem the Arab, one of the guys, the opponents of Israel, was mentioned, and they were somewhat maybe afraid that, you know, Geshem might come in and do that. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. It says that they would not stoop to serve their Lord, and that suggests a kind of pridefulness. They would not bend the neck. They weren't willing to get their hands dirty. You know, the high priest was willing to get his hands dirty. The rulers of the Tekoites were not. What's interesting is to look at the Tekoites, the people. The rulers wouldn't do that, but the Tekoites did repair this section of the wall next to Zadok, the son of Bana. The other thing is, we see later on in verse 27, after him, the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting tower. Leaders wouldn't get involved, but the people who were outside of Israel, who had to travel in, repaired two sections. It's just amazing, you know, when you see the contrast there. When we look at Nehemiah recording this, people who deserved praise were praised. People who didn't received a pretty unflattering report. And throughout church history, you know, I mean, for, you know, let's figure about the last, you know, 2,400 years, you know, the rulers, these people who refused to stoop to serve the Lord, have become a byword for people that wouldn't play nice with others, that didn't want to be involved, that refused to stoop their neck to be involved in the work of the Lord. There's a shamefulness that comes from that. And the challenge is that when we think about, here's Nehemiah's evaluation of them, how about God's? You know, when all of these people stand before God and he looks at them for all the good things that they've done, I imagine that the Tekoites, man, you guys traveled in, you repaired two sections of the wall. You went even above and beyond some of the residents of Jerusalem. Well done. What is he going to say to the rulers who refuse to stoop to contribute to the Lord's purpose? There's a warning in here for us. What is God going to say when his kingdom is built and we stand before him and he says, Brian, And what'd you do for my kingdom? Oh, you were too busy, you know, working, trying to provide for your family. That's good. That's not bad. That's good. But where'd you serve me in that? I mean, I'm glad you got a nice car. I'm glad I don't. Well, they're not. I mean, they're good, but you know what I mean. I'm glad you got a nice car and you got a nice house and all that kind of stuff. But where was your thought for me? You had one job to do. Did you do it? This reminds us that we don't want to be the person that has to say, man, I have nothing to show, Lord, for the purpose that you've given me. It's a God-given purpose. All of us have a responsibility. And to that end, I'd like to suggest two steps of application. The first thing is, I hit the wrong button. There we go. Plan a way to remind ourselves of our calling daily. A calling to walk worthy, as we see in Ephesians 4:1. A calling to share our faith with others. Here's Faith 101. God's evaluation of our faithfulness to him is based on whether we're engaged in his mission. If we want to, you know, be received by him and for him to say, well done, my good and faithful servant, that's whether we're involved in his mission is the primary thing that he's going to be looking at. Now, working hard for our families, that's good. That actually is part of you know, walking worthy of the calling, not abandoning our families, being responsible for them. And there's nothing wrong with working hard to enjoy the fruit of our labor. Where those things become bad things is if that's all we're working for. If we can do that and we can also contribute to the ministry of the Lord, and we've got that balance in our lives, that's something where, you know, we have numerous examples in Scripture where the work in our hands and the work that we can do, we can take pride in, we can enjoy the fruit of it. But it's also something that is able to bless others as we, you know, when that fruit, you know, comes in and we, you know, we make a contribution and the payment that comes in from that, it's not just a selfish end, but it's something that we can then give more to bless others. That's the picture. Not that they're mutually exclusive, but that they need to be both and. My take is that in North America today, and just America in general, most of us emphasize the providing for our families, working hard to enjoy the fruits of our labor. But what gets the short end of the stick is God and his mission. We're going to stand before God. We're going to have to answer for him. And the challenge is that I'm reminding you of that now. The urgency of that is going to wear off tomorrow morning when the alarm goes off at, you know, whatever, oh, dark 30. And you've got to get up and you've got to go to work and you're running through and then you've got, you know, traffic jams and all that kind of stuff. We lose the sight of that unless we intentionally make it a part of our lives to remind ourselves. Here's a challenge for you. Wake up in the morning and start in prayer. Wake up and your first thought to be, Lord, hey, this is a new day. I'm going to go. I want you to help me to be sensitive to the opportunities that I may have to be able to advance your mission today. Because in that prayer and in thinking that, we're reminding ourselves about his mission. Throughout the day when we have those opportunities to pray, let's remember, you know, Lord, you know, guide me. There's something that you need me to do that I'm missing. Help me to see that. That awareness, if it can be a daily thing, is something that's going to help us to keep the right perspective, to not lose it in the hubbub of daily life. Final thing that I'd suggest is to commit to discover and use our gifts to build up the church. I said and or because some of us might know what our gifts are. We may not be using them. Some of us may not know what they are. We need to discover them. Then we need to use them. I know many of you have discovered them and are using them. And that's awesome. Here's the picture. God desires every Christian to flourish, to reflect a fullness of life that stems from our relationship with him. Part of that flourishing is our activity involved in God's plan. If we're not involved in his plan, he's wired us to do a certain thing, and we're not doing that, there's always a part of us that's going to be feeling like we haven't reached our potential. We haven't achieved the fullness that God has for us. We recognize that God has given each of us a manifestation of the Spirit for the common good, that's something that's designed, God has given us to help one another out. If we're not using that to help one another out, there are two people that are suffering from that. There are people who are not receiving that gift. that would be encouraged by it, that would be challenged by it, that would be built up by it. In other words, your brothers and sisters here in the church, some of them are probably not achieving what they can achieve because we're not doing our part. And because we're not doing our part, we too are missing out. Challenges, let's discover it. And I threw a couple of things in there. Pray to ask God to help us identify how he's wired you. These are in your notes. Think and organize. What do I see as my spiritual gifts? What do I get passionate about in service? What abilities and talents has God given me? How's my personality, my education, experiences work in there? You may be saying, well, gosh, you know, spiritual gifts, that's like mumbo jumbo. I have no idea how to work with that. I am glad you thought that thought, because next week we have a seminar that we're going to be looking at spiritual gifts. Come to the seminar. And if some part of your abilities and skill set involves cooking, make chili, right? Come and bring that, and we'll see, you know, and you can contribute that chili, and we'll have a great time, you know, doing that. If you know what it is, or even if you're in that process of starting to figure out, one of the best things that I can tell you, if you don't know where to serve, start serving somewhere. If you find out that it's not the place for you, okay, that's fine. Start serving somewhere else. Try different things until you get a place where you're going, you know, this really is encouraging. I'm really seeing my effort making a difference in other people's lives. If you're not feeling that in the place where you're at, okay, find somewhere else. Move around. It's okay to do that. I wish that, you know, if you come into my office that I can just lay my hand on you and say, you need to serve here. I don't get to do that. And sometimes the only way that I can see that and that others can see that is when we see you getting into something and say, you know, in this activity, here's where I see a shining, but this isn't working so well. Let's find something else to use this gift. And then you can, you know, slowly but surely help, you know, identify where it is that sweet spot is for you. And that leads to the last point, is that, you know, if we think of the Christian life as something that I do on my own, I'm limited in what I can see. A lot of times where I'm going to be effective is something that people are going to see outside. They're going to be able to look in at an interested third party, and they're going to be able to say, Brian, wow, you know what? When I see you doing this, I see God doing amazing things. I mean, I may not see it. So one of the important things is that we surround ourselves with other Christians, get to know them so that they can see in our lives. That sometimes the desires of our heart that may not be fully clear to us can sometimes come out to them when they see us get passionate about something. That communal effort is something that is amazing. This is where a group project is a very good thing. And so a suggestion, if you're not involved in a small group or a Bible study, get involved. Get to know other Christians. Let them get to know you. And then as you get to know one another, look and see, how can I encourage this person to use the gifts that God has given them, even as they look to do the same for you? That's all I have. I'm going to ask the worship team to come up, and I'm going to close this in a word of prayer, and we'll be sent out with a word of singing. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this day. It's just amazing to me when I see a group of people like these men and women of Jerusalem that were so motivated toward a Godward purpose. Father, I pray that you would help us to be able to latch onto our purpose today. For us to just have a sense that there's more to life than just waking up, going to work, buying things, going to bed. We have a purpose. That we would look for ways that we can contribute to that purpose. That we can look for ways to be able to achieve all that you want us to achieve. Father, I know just from personal experience what it is to have a sense of what you've called me to do. To be able to do that and to find that even though it has some frustrations in some ways, that there's more joy than I could imagine anywhere else. Father, I pray that for each of our people, each of us today, that you'd help us to see that. If we are serving, to find joy in that, to know that we do what we do in honor of you. If we don't know what our gifts are, if we're not serving somewhere, Father, that you would ignite a desire to find that contribution that we can make. Challenge us to not let that go but to seek it out and to make the contribution that you have wired us to be able to make. Father, we ask this in the name of your Son. Amen.